Welcome to Warships Pod, and this is part two of our latest discussion with Captain Doug Littlejohns. And we begin with looking at a key role Doug played in persuading the UK that it should renew its nuclear deterrent, going from Polaris to Trident. Welcome back, Doug.
Hello, Ian.
Talking about defence and things being sexy, there is one particular part of your experiences in the Cold War, and this time it was a Whitehall Warrior in the main building, the Ministry of Defence in London. And this relates to Shapps talking up the Dreadnought class and them being built and going to succeed the Vanguard class Trident missile submarines. And so we're now in that period where I would say that a huge investment is going on in the nuclear deterrent force in submarines. And somebody has to kind of explain to the public and make a case for it. And I wonder if they really are making a case for it. So you had a job in the 1980s in MOD, as I've said, in actually trying to make Trident sexy, didn't you?
Yes, I actually managed to be on a BBC Panorama programme about the replacement of Polaris. And in those days, it was easier because we had a Defence Secretary, George Younger, who, rest in peace, great man. He actually had an understanding of defence. We needed to put, let's get a step back. Having a nuclear deterrent is not the Navy's decision. The politics decide, well, it's a political decision to have a nuclear deterrent. It's then, the military then advises the politicians on what is the best and most cost-effective method of having a nuclear deterrent. And it comes down, in the case of nearly every country that's considered it, to submarine launch missiles. The problem that we got now is, well, so problem I had in my time, that the resolution class was going to be 25, 30 years old. And it was running up against cooler submarines, which were the replacement of the Victor III. And they were very capable submarines, as a result of the Walker Whitman spy case. And so we had to do something, because the last thing a deterrent needs is for the head of the Politburo to stand up and say, today we have been trailing a Royal Navy nuclear deterrent submarine. Well, that just destroys your deterrence. And I don't know what's going on at the moment. I mean, the Dreadnought class is way, way late. Originally, it was going to be 2024. then it was going to be 2028. And now it's sometime in the 2030s. Meantime, we're running on the Vanguard class, which are basically, in our definition, old bangers. And, you know, I take my hat off to the engineers in particular, who keep at least one of them going, and the crew members who go away for 6 months at a time, which to my mind is horrendous. We can't replace the Vanguard class quickly enough, in my mind. But to keep on this business of nuclear deterrence, don't forget, everybody should realize that, we're not planning to have a nuclear war. Nuclear weapons are weapons of peace, or weapons for peace. And we can come on to ladders of escalation in a minute, but they have kept the peace. But in the situation we talked about right at the beginning of this chat, we used to have two sides of people who understood what would happen if there was a nuclear exchange. Now I'm not so sure that we do.
It is very worrying. I mean, if you take the Russians, just one of the players in our world today that seems to think you can hurl missiles around, and whether testing them or threatening them, and make dark threats against nations.
Oh, well, Putin is a great threatener. I mean, it's bluster. isn't it?
Yeah.
Because,
well, yeah, yeah. I mean, he does it with a kind of sly smile.
But he's been getting away with it because people have been folding up. I think they've worked out now that he's a worry, but I don't think he's a worry for throwing nuclear weapons around.
No. I mean, we must all pray that, and even in the mind of the North Korean dictator, that that there is reality there, that actually you can never have nuclear war, because to have nuclear war is just the annihilation of everything, including your own dreams of imperialistic conquest, wherever that is, or just dominating, you know, Japan or South Korea, whatever it is you're up to. So we should hope that they will have that embedded deep in their minds, even if they don't seem to exercise, shall we say, due caution with all their wild threats of hurling nuclear weapons around. And one of the things that I found fascinating about your career was the background. I don't want to call it maneuvering, because you don't indulge in maneuvering, Doug. The background shenanigans, not down to you, but the things that happen in the corridors of power. And there were two episodes which I think illustrate for people how somebody like yourself, a staff officer with deep, you know, knowledge of the reality of the Cold War at sea and the risks that can be taken. And one of those is the fact that it was essential that the UK had a plan B for if a Polaris submarine, a Resolution class submarine, was detected, which you mentioned the Resolution class just a few moments ago. And also the Reykjavik summit, where I gather that you came in, you were watching television at night and saw something happening between Reagan and Gorbachev at the Hofty House, where they were having a disarmament talk or an arms limitation talk in 1986, and that kind of set the alarm bells ringing. So can you give us some insights into those two elements?
As I said earlier, the concern was that the Resolution class, which was 1960s technology, and in the late 1980s, was no longer against Soviet diesel submarines or noisy nuclear submarines. It was against things like the Akula. And so I decided I would brief the First Sea Lord via the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff about, we ought to have a plan if the Soviet leader stands up and says, we are currently in contact with a Royal Navy Polaris submarine, because that would just destroy the credibility of the deterrent. And so I managed to convince my boss and the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff that we ought to have this plan B, and we crafted a press release or a line to take, which was taken to the then First Sea Lord, Admiral Staveley, who in the course of the briefing must have smoked about five or six cigarettes. But he agreed, and that press release went into his safe, and thankfully it's never had to come out. It might still be there, as far as I know. On the other one, yes, watching television, I thought I realized that President Reagan had just given away our deterrent and the French deterrent. And I beetled into the office early the next morning, and my two staff officers, Nick and Jim, were there before me, because they'd also watched the television. So we crafted a brief about the implications of what Reagan and Gorbachev have been talking about, passed it up the chain. It went across to number 10, and Margaret Thatcher, who understood nuclear deterrence, grasped it immediately. And that led to her famous trip to see Ronnie and him picking her up in the golf buggy. And we wrote, I don't know, a page and a half or 2 pages of brief. By the time it went across to her with all the other additions added to it, was about 6 or 7 pages. I saw a copy of it when it came back, and basically she had gone through the brief with a pen and highlighted the important bits, and i.e. the bits that we thought were important, and put in there, because she got it. She really got it, and I was very impressed by that.
And what happened there, just so the listeners can be filled in some of the background, was that the at the conference in Iceland at Reykjavik, Reagan and Gorbachev discussed basically limiting nuclear weapons, not getting rid of them altogether, but moving towards getting rid of them altogether. And Reagan tried at the conference to insist that the UK and French deterrent forces, both sea-based, both in submarines, had to be independent of a conversation about limitations involving Russia and America. But Gorbachev disagreed with that. And Reagan felt the Russians and Americans should lead by example. He gave in to Gorbachev on that point about the UK and French deterrence being included. And he felt that the Russian, this is Reagan, felt the Russians and Americans should lead by example with 50% of their strategic offensive nukes gone by 1991, and all of them by, I think, 1996. The thing that ruined the conference, apart from upsetting the French and the British about their deterrent, was the Strategic Defence Initiative, which was a no-go area for the Americans. And that was a combination. And people kind of scoffed at this at the time. And that was anti-ballistic missiles and lasers to shoot down Russian ballistic missiles. So what it meant was that if the Russians tried to launch first, or if they tried to launch in retaliation, the Americans would have these lasers, I think some of them in space, and then ground-based missiles to shoot them down, and they wouldn't be able to hit America. So that would neutralize, nullify the advantage, any advantage that either side might have. And Reagan actually wanted to give SDI to the world and give it to everybody, because strangely enough, he was characterized as a bit of a warmonger at the time. He was actually into getting rid of nuclear weapons very much. And the Russians didn't want SDI to become more than a scientific research project. And so the talks in Iceland in October 1986 collapsed. And then the meeting you're talking about, where Mrs. Thatcher went across and Ronald Reagan picked her up in a golf buggy from after the helicopter landed her, was at Camp David. But the interesting thing that strikes me about that whole episode, apart from Mrs. Thatcher having to go over there and tell Ronald Reagan off for acting unilaterally when it comes to giving away other people's deterrent force, and he actually apologized for that, said he shouldn't have done that, is that today we're now in a situation where we have anti-ballistic missile ships in the Red Sea shooting down ballistic missiles, and lasers are actually being worked on. So it's like 40 years later almost, we've come back to SDI, which I think is quite strange. And it shows that you have to invest in cutting edge stuff, but you have to have warships as a platform for the ballistic missile defense. And it has to be near where the enemy's launching them if you have to get into that crazy game. And the same goes for lasers, which I think will come to the fore in this area, and in shooting down drones as well as things like Houthi ballistic missiles. So when it comes to conventional deterrent forces, and this goes back to your ladder of escalation aspect that you mentioned a few minutes ago, where how important or how out of whack do you think we are now with that essential balance between conventional deterrent and nuclear deterrent?
I'm very worried, and you've heard me on this before. You've got to have credible conventional forces to make sure that your nuclear forces, the deterrence posture, is credible, not incredible. I mean, to put it into simple terms, we're effectively almost saying to the world, if you come along and kick our shins, we'll nuke you. Now, that is just not credible. The whole point about the ladder of escalation is, if you're going to, God forbid, have some kind of war, you start off bashing away with your conventional forces. And if it looks as though one side with a nuclear weapon is losing, and there is a threat to the national survival of that country, then at the back of the enemy's mind, it might just unleash a nuclear weapon. And that gives some credibility to the whole thing. Don't forget I said before, nuclear weapons are weapons for peace, so they stop people going over the top. At the moment, if you look at our conventional forces, or indeed the conventional forces in NATO, if you take the Americans out of it, it's not really very credible. And although on paper, this is where the conundrum is, on paper, if you look at the Soviet or Russian forces against NATO, and you thought, if they had a massive attack, would they win, and would they lead to the consideration of nuclear weapons? On paper, until they invaded Ukraine and made a mess of it, you would have said probably yes. But now it's a question of whether, in answer to the question I've just posed, whether they could actually upset NATO to that extent. But it's not something you want to be taking a risk with. You're back to NATO defense spending and a whole raft of other questions. I hope that answers the point you were trying to make.
Yeah, yeah. What worries me is we're now in an era where, for example, in 1991, when Desert Storm, as the Americans called it, evicted the Iraqis from Kuwait, a massive undertaking. I mean, there were 500,000 coalition troops, a division of the British Army, you know, masses of the Americans and naval forces, and you know, seven or eight carriers with aircraft, and then the French were somewhere over in the west. We weren't quite sure where they were, but there was massive. It was a massive war, and 100, 200 or 300 coalition forces were killed, and that seemed like a terrible thing. You know, even to lose five or six people, and some of that was blue on blue. But thousands of Iraqis. I mean, I went into the desert. I went out to Kuwait at the end of the war, but also a year later out into the desert to watch them clearing cluster bombs and mines in Kuwait. I was out there with the Royal Marines, so we took a day out to go and see them in the south of Kuwait, clearing this stuff up. And thousands of Iraqis died in that desert under the pummeling that the coalition air force gave them. And nobody cared about that because they couldn't see it. So then we move on to the war on terror and other things. So I think you talk about the ladder of escalation. I think we're getting into an era, even with all the communication, social media and other stuff that we've got, where the ladder of ignorance is being climbed towards disaster about how many people die and the damage and the horror of conventional war. So if you look at Ukraine, thousands of people have died. But actually, if you're in Europe or you're in Moscow, you know, Putin, or you're in London or wherever you are, and you don't see that, and there is basically a bit of a news blackout, certainly on the Ukrainian side, and we don't see it. So I think the worrying thing for me is that people are accepting. And if you look at Gaza as well, where the Hamas committed that horrendous atrocity and the massacre and kidnap people, but now we've got Israel leveling Gaza, where thousands of people are dying. So, you know, the Israelis suffered more than 1,000 killed and people kidnapped, which is horrendous. And it was a war crime that enters the annals of the top war crimes. But now we're now getting accusations with Israel for war crimes, with them leveling Gaza. So we have a horrific war, and we're not quite, we don't really see the cost of it even today. And so the thing that worries me is that people have lost reality, and they don't understand that you cannot start these things. And this brings us back to nuclear weapons. So being war weapons for peace in the way that you mentioned them, as long as people are rational and realise you can't use them and they're not first strike, stops those wars happening, or used to. But now it appears it doesn't.
Well, that's why I start right at the beginning of this. You know, it's a much, the Armageddon clock is at 90 seconds to midnight.
Yes.
Closest it's ever been since it was invented. And there's a very good reason for it, because it's interesting just talking to friends around here where I live. And it's, some of the ex-military people obviously get excited about what's going on in Ukraine, but many others just see it as a, I hate to put it like that, but this is some kind of video game. And it hasn't affected their lives. It hasn't impacted them in any way. And they're not more worried about where the next ice cream's coming from, or the next bite of beer.
Yeah. And then when you get people like Putin or whoever whoever they are, who have a moment of irrational behavior and misjudgment, then all of a sudden you're in it. And that's the thing I worry about today.
Well, there are several world leaders who could be described as capable of being irrational. Yes.
Yeah, at the moment. And that's the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. That's what you were referring to. They are the people that always say, how far is, just to be cheery here, how far is mankind from annihilation due to nuclear weapons, natural catastrophe, potential for other disasters to happen. And they have for 2 years in a row put it at 90 seconds to midnight, midnight being the crack of doom. So let's hope it doesn't get any closer. And so in dealing with the world we're in now, it seems we have now entered a period where the world has gone back to turmoil and turbulence and imbalance, strategic risk. And we had a period from 1991 to what, 2001 or later for most of the world, if not the Middle East and, you know, wherever terrorism afflicted the world. And we're now in a new era. But in fact, it's very much like the past. It was always turbulent. There were always things going on. But one of the things that keeps the world turning is global trade. And people don't seem to understand that when the Houthis fire missiles out into the sea lanes, they say Israeli ships and to assist the cause of the people of Gaza to resist the Israelis. But in reality, since 2016, they've been firing missiles at merchant ships, and the Iranians have been attacking merchant ships as well with drones, and even attacked a merchant ship last year with a frigate. So this terrorizing of merchant trade and attacking merchant trade has been going on for years. And so you were the captain of, we'll only go into this briefly because we discussed it on a previous podcast, but you're the captain of HMS London, a frigate, as I think we referenced earlier. And you had the job of going down in 1988, the summer of 1988, and escorting merchant vessels, not in the Red Sea, but in and out of the Gulf, huge tankers and things. But to protect those vessels from air attack by Iranian and Iraqi jets, we're armed with Exocets, and in fact, American supplied Mavericks. That was the Iranians. Both sides were attacking merchant vessels in the Gulf because they were locked in the Iran-Iraq war and were trying to, let's say, disrupt the trade and the income of each side in their massive horrendous land war. But there were also mines. And there were also small boats attacking as well. So that was the situation. The tanker war of the late 1980s was in some ways similar to the Red Sea. And so that also involved Anglo-American cooperation. So without doing too much of what we did in the last podcast, how do you think it compares, the level of threat or the cooperation between the Americans and the British?
Oh, it's much more tense now. Just to go back briefly to 1988, when a new warship from any nation, there were Soviets out there, Americans, French, all sorts of ships. Whenever a new ship arrived on station, the Iranians would come out and test it. And if you were, as we were able to do, show them that we meant business, then they left us alone after that. We heard of some Iraqi aircraft hanging around and coming in to try and frighten us. And we had laser weapons, laser dazzle weapons on board. Just point them at the incoming aircraft, and they got the buzz and went away again. So that was it. That was much more of a gentleman war, if you can call it that. It would be it's a much different thing. You're sitting in your ship in the Red Sea under constant threat of attack. And so therefore your crew, the commander, your officers have to be absolutely on the ball, and maybe a 2 minute warning if something's coming at you. So Tom Sharp, who's son of a very illustrious nuclear submarine commander, Richard Sharp, has written very well about this in the Telegraph, about the stress and strains of trying to be at that sort of alertness for a long period of time. It's very, very wearing. And you're only allowed to make one mistake, then it's all over.
Yeah.
So it's a different ball game altogether.
Yeah, and I think it is the most intense combat situation that a Royal Navy warship has faced since, you could say, since the Falklands War, in terms of the amount of attacks and the duration of the intensity and being defence watches aboard ship, waiting for the enemy and, you know, and getting ready to respond. But during the Kuwait thing, Desert Storm, as we'll call it, just for ease of reference, the British called it Operation Granby, but I think Desert Storm is a little bit more fitting. Of course, the Royal Navy was up threat, and there were worries about due partly to the tanker war because of the air attacks during the tanker war on merchant ships, waiting for Iraqi aircraft to make some kind of foray and to make a mass attack on the Royal Navy and American warships up the Sharp End. And there were mines, and there was that memorably there was the missiles fired by the Iraqis at the end of the war from Kuwait out to sea to try and hit something. They weren't terribly well guided. One of them splashed on takeoff. The other one came down towards the Anglo-American task group and seemed to be heading in the direction of an American battleship and one of the last two battleships to see action in history. And HMS Gloucester used her Sea Dart missiles fired to take out that missile. And so that was a remarkable event. But now we have the Red Sea, and you're right, Tom Sharp, who's been on the podcast, has written very well on this. There's been weeks now of missiles being fired and drones. So you've got to give your, you know, a big tribute to those young men and young women in HMS Diamond and the American warships and any warship that's there for fending this off, because it is incredibly intense. One mistake and that's it. And a lot of people could die. And I don't think people in the UK or elsewhere actually realise the intensity and the strain that that puts on people for a duration.
No, there's been very little coverage. Now, when Diamond shot down a missile, wasn't it? Or was it a drone? I can't remember. But they shot something down. And it got a 30-second clip on the news. What it would have been nice is to cover some acts in the ops room of that ship to show, as you say, the stress and strain that our young people are under, and the commanding officer who's got to be, he and his team have got to be right every single time. And of course, we were dealing with a sort of militarized approach from the Iraqis and the Iranians, because they were in a war. Now you're dealing with guerrillas. And as the Americans are going to find out yet again, post-Vietnam and all that, a conventional army, navy cannot beat guerrillas in the conventional way. And it bothers me, straying off the subject a little bit, but we've got the Israelis and the Hamas thing, where no matter what the Israelis seem to do, they can't stop rockets from Hamas coming back into Israel. And the Americans have embarked on this, if I can call it, pinprick approach against the Houthis. And the parallels between what the Israelis and the Hamas are up to and the Americans and the Houthis are up to is too close for my comfort. I think we're attacking the West. We're attacking the wrong stuff. The only way to stop the guerrillas, I mean, they might be 16-year-old kids firing these things, is to stop the supply of the weapons. And that can only be done by engaging with Iran one way or another.
I mean, Royal Navy ships in particular in the past 2 years, at least twice, and American warships have intercepted arms shipments on dhows of ballistic missile technology and other weaponry from Iran to the Houthis. And this was before the outbreak of today. And two US Navy SEALs were lost at sea when they one of them fell off and the other tried to rescue him when they were boarding a dhow, which turned out to have weapons equipment, I think missile technology, on board. So they're trying that. But you're right, the way to stop it is to cut off the supply of the weaponry and make it solid so that they cannot be resupplied. And that's the way to stop it, because otherwise, if you don't do that, they just keep, and it's not a laughing matter, they just keep receiving the weaponry and they keep firing it because they'll move around, you know.
Well, the Saudis have thrown, somebody I read somewhere, 64,000 bits of munition into the Houthis since, 2016. How to stop them? The only way to stop them is to take away the toys.
And also, I suppose, make it clear diplomatically and otherwise that to Iran or whoever's supplying the weaponry that this is not the way to go. And also persuade them that it should stop, basically. Because although they use one justification for it, really, it's a proxy war by Iran on merchant shipping to pressure the West. And it's all tied up with what Iran's doing elsewhere. It's the axis of, what do they call it? The axis of resistance, which...
I quite agree, but... I'm a simple sailor. I'm staying out of the high level.
Yeah, well, we rely on politicians and diplomats to do that, you know. As you said, tread softly, but with a big stick. And to be effective, to stop the wars and deter the wars and try and solve them before it gets too bad. But that's difficult. But in the meantime, young people, and it is your oldest young people, are being asked to take risks and put themselves in the firing line. And to make them serve in a destroyer like Diamond or a frigate like HMS Richmond or HMS Lancaster or an American destroyer and an aircraft carrier that's out there with lots of missiles and drones being fired at them, doing the bidding of their government to try and preserve the flow of world trade, of global trade, sea trade, then you've got to give them terms of service, conditions of service, pay, and feel like they're actually part of a worthy cause. And it seems to me that the UK, and it's not something that other navies and other military don't suffer from. The Americans have the same challenge, but they're just not getting the number, or they haven't been getting the number of recruits through the door that they've needed. So there are now shortages, no matter how many are now showing interest due to all the business in the Red Sea. But they've got to, once they get into the Navy, the Royal Navy in particular, which is, you know, we're a British podcast, let's talk about the Royal Navy. Once they get into the Royal Navy, they've got to feel that they're valued and that they're doing a worthwhile job and they're well paid and their conditions of service and where they live, if they're in accommodation, is good. And clearly, the message hasn't really been getting across to people. And also, the system itself, it's no secret, has been slow and turgid when it comes to trying to get young people through the door and into the service. So it strikes me, though, that this is not new. I mean, in the Georgian era, they solved it by sending out press gangs to steal mariners and landlubbers and stick them on warships. But that was a different era, of course. You can't do that today. But in the 70s, through writing Hunter Killers and talking to you and other sailors of the time, the mid-70s, the early to mid-70s, the Royal Navy also had a problem with retaining people in service, and the conditions of service were not quite what they were. So looking back on what you may have seen of that in the 70s, what is the secret to keeping people in the Navy or recruiting them in the first place?
Well, there's a thing called the military covenant, which I'm afraid it's political rhubarb. But I go back to my time when I took HMS London up the Thames and parked it alongside Belfast in 1988, yes, before I went to the Gulf. And I was showing a bunch of bankers around in the ops room. And then I said, you know, before we go and have a lunchtime drink, any questions? And one of them put his hand up and said, well, Captain, well, what's your pay? So I proudly stood up and said, £44,000. And he said, a month? And I realized then that maybe we hadn't quite got it right. Well, and earlier in the late 1970s, Jim Callaghan, Prime Minister, came down to open HMS Defiance in Devonport Dockyard, the submarine maintenance base. And he insisted on coming on board HMS Superb, where I was the second in command. And we just come back from a northern patrol, which had been delayed 1 week because our American relief had a maintenance problem. And so we arrived in the harbour, and instead of being able to give the crew the much-deserved leave, we all had to turn to with buckets and scrubbers and clean the submarine up so that the Prime Minister could come aboard. He came aboard, and luckily he didn't ask any sailor how he'd got on, because he would have got an absolute earful. Shortly afterwards, Callum was thrown out, Thatcher came in, and my crew, about half my crew, were in the position where their wives were claiming social security benefits. They were so badly paid. Margaret Thatcher came in, gave us a thumping great pay rise. And in fact, my pay doubled in 6 months. Now we fast forward to today. We have this recruiting contract out with Capita, which seems to be completely devoid of interpersonal contact. It's all done with television interviews and Zoom meetings and stuff like that. But a lot of recruits joined the Navy because they went into the local recruiting office and there was a hairy sailor or marine or somebody could tell them stirring stories about what it was like. But now, not only do you not meet anybody until you join, but also it can take 18 months or so. One at Tavistock Golf Club, we had a very nice young man serving behind the bar a few years back, and he had been selected to join the Royal Signals. And he was so pleased and so happy. And then the next week, he got a letter saying, yes, and we'll accept you in 18 months. And he completely deflated, went off, got a different job. And so we're not recruiting in the right way. We're not putting real people out there to meet real people. We're not paying our sailors enough. I read somewhere £18,000 a year, which in comparison with driving a tube train, where's that? And we're just not doing it right. Now, we're not looking after them in the right quarter. If you drive back around the back of Stonehenge, through the Army Marine Corps, saying you see the state they're in, they're a national disgrace. So we're not just, defence is on the back burner, and it will stay there until the public wakes up, if they do wake up, and to say, a la Fisher time, we want eight and we won't wait. I can't see it coming, but we need something like that. Yeah, you
mean when the public, that was when the Navy League existed, to campaign for the Navy. And they said, we need, with the Kaiser's fleet coming up and war looming, we need eight battle cruisers now, and we're not going to wait for them, and cause quite a stir. But that was when you had Churchill and Fisher, two incredibly dynamic whirlwinds at play. But I just hope, and it won't go this way, I'm sure, but in 1931, the Atlantic Fleet sent on its summer manoeuvres to Invergordon and about to deploy to the Atlantic. Actually, it wasn't a mutiny, because that mutinies in the Royal Navy, I think, are very few and far between. And certainly the last one was a minesweeper in the 1970s. But that was down to the officers entertaining somebody in the wardroom who the ratings were outraged by. And so they went, they staged a mutiny. That was the last mutiny in the Royal Navy. But in 1931, the Atlantic Fleet decided the money, they had their pay cut. The people that joined after a certain time were not going to get the same money as other people, and they staged what was basically a down tools. And so the fleet didn't put to sea. And at one stage, some of the sailors were going to march on the Prime Minister's house, and they decided not to do that. And some of them were Bolsheviks, and there was a great deal of raucous behaviour on board warships, including HMS Rodney, which became known as the Red Rodney, because it allegedly had all these communist troublemakers on board. Some of them were communists, but there weren't that many of them. It was just basically a reaction amongst the lower deck, not among the Royal Marines or the officers, but the lower deck, the ordinary ratings, and so I don't think the senior ratings either, but the junior ratings, to the appalling pay and conditions, to their wives in Devonport and Portsmouth and Chatham and wherever else, who were having to, well, in some cases, prostitute themselves to actually get any money. It was, you know, it was a terrible time for the Royal Navy, and it was in a state. But things bounced back. The commander of the Atlantic Fleet was binned, and the morale was restored. There was a bit of a witch hunt to get the troublemakers. They were booted out of the Navy. But that was an extreme measure. I can't see anything like that happening today. I hope that our politicians across the board, Grant Shapps et al., reach a state of reality, not only about where the Navy is right now, not where it's going to be with the wonder ships in 5 years' time, and what they need to do right now, regardless of a general election coming, to sort things out and to look after the people and the warships and the other kit.
I agree with all of that. But I wish politicians would stop coming out with the dreaded mantra that there's another 2 billion here and another billion there, and we are the fifth biggest spenders on defence in the world, and we spend our 2% to meet the NATO targets. It's not a question of more and more billions necessarily. It's a question of spending the money properly. And clearly, when you don't look after the people who defend you, then you're not doing it right. It not necessarily means more money. It means the MOD and the civil service and the politicians and the senior officers have got to sit down and sort out where the money's going. And to claim that we're up on our 2% target, that includes my pension and stuff like that. Now, unless we're going to have a dad's navy, I am not part of the defence of this country. So it's complete nonsense, and it's all hot air, and I just get so fed up with it all. We probably spend enough money, we just don't spend it properly, and we don't look after our people, and therefore the message gets out and nobody wants to pay.
And
if you come back from a six-month patrol in a Trident submarine, you manage to go home for a bit, the politician comes and shakes you by the hand and saying, oh, you've got a new world record. Tell that to the partner who's been languishing ashore, particularly when the sailor is told, go away, have some leave, come back, do it again. And guess what? They say, no thanks. Yeah. We're not looking after our people properly. And we're not spending the money drop. Sorry, that's a bit negative.
No, but that's truth. Truth to power.
Yeah. Right. End of rant.
And I think end of the podcast, really. We'll try and be cheerful, but you know, you've got to look at things that need sorting out and try at least to have some kind of discussion on this podcast. And who knows, maybe the private pike of today's UK defence, Grant Shapps, he'll pay attention. He might listen to it and take away some pearls of wisdom. So thanks very much for a discussion today, Doug, across those many topics, trying to tie in some reflections from the Cold War with just a few bits of chat about where we are today.
Yeah, and it's always a pleasure to chat with you.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.